juggernauts and Cinderellas, redemption and validation. Anything you could possibly want will be on display this weekend in the Final Four in the greater Phoenix area. This is the College Game Day podcast for Wednesday, April 3rd. Reese Davis and Pete Thamel here. Pete, both of us will be in the desert for the Final Four. Looking forward to that, as always. It's a grand event every year. And this one has a different feel because you have the two Goliaths. I don't know that over the course of the season that they separated themselves the way Gonzaga and Baylor did a few years ago, where you always felt like that was almost an inevitable clash, but it was close. And then you have the other two stories with NC State coming from nowhere. And after, you know, decades of tournament frustration and, you know, Sweet 16 exits, Alabama finally breaks through. So there's a storyline for everybody. But prevailing one seems to be the UConn juggernaut, the difficulty of repeating as champion. I wrote an essay which will air later this week and will be updated and tweaked should UConn win the championship again, about the fact that I don't believe there's really any such thing as a repeat champion, really, really in all of sports, but in particularly in college basketball, because of the constant chaos and churn and the mental approach you need, which is not to try to repeat, but to realize that you're starting the climb all over again with either different people or certainly the people returning in grander roles. And yet here UConn is, as good as it was in the tournament last year. They've been even better. I was maybe alive at the end, but I don't really remember the UCLA dominance. But I don't remember in my lifetime anybody running through a tournament and having a 30-point lead at some point in every game prior to the Final Four. I've never seen it.
Yeah, we're on the cusp of history here. We are witnessing a juggernaut, and it's certainly too early to say they are the greatest NCAA tournament team we've ever seen, but it's not too early to put them right in that conversation if they continue on the pace and the clip that they are on. Reese, I agree 100%. Like, college basketball is a year-to-year business. One year has very little to do with the next. There is very little continuity. And I think one of the impressive things about this UConn team compared to the last team that repeated, which was Florida, and I believe 06 and 07, was that they returned all five starters and ran it back. And look, that's hard. It's still hard.
Yeah, it's impressive. Yeah.
UConn basically lost three key linchpins and then had a mix of Donovan Klingon going from a backup to a starter to replace Sanogo. They bring Cam Spencer in from Rutgers, and he's Rutgers. Unbelievable. What a pest, right? And they have just sort of figured out, and then they have Stephon Castle, who is probably going to be a top 10 pick, who's been awesome. Tristan Newton, again, has grown to another level from being a great point guard to a first team All-American point guard. But they've done it with a lot of different pieces, and it's so hard to have sustained success. That's why I laugh when these coaches get fired and they have one bad year. It's like, it's just, there's so many variables right now in modern college basketball to go from year to year. But I was a witness in Boston this weekend to UConn in person, and I have never seen a run as devastating as the one they put on from the end of, it was tied at 23, and then they scored 30 straight. Like, that's like hard to wrap your mind around.
And Pete, they didn't shoot the ball well from the perimeter.
We have 17.
Nothing. Yeah, I mean, 30 nothing run is remarkable, no matter how you score the points. And you rarely see it even in a regular season game, if ever. I don't remember seeing a 30-0 run. But if it were to happen, you think, okay, well, these cats, you know, hit 7 threes in 8 trips, you know, or something like that. They've won 2 tournament games this year in which they blew out good opponents, and in Illinois' case, a really, really good opponent.
Really
good. And they didn't shoot well, which from the perimeter. They obviously shot well inside the arc and at the rim, but they didn't shoot well from the perimeter. And that sort of leaves you wondering. I mean, they have to turn in their, you know, their C game, sort of like maybe they did midseason in the Creighton game. You know, turned in a, you know, Creighton's a really good team. UConn probably turned in a
B to B minus to C plus effort that night. Not in trying, but I mean, in terms of performance, that's probably what it takes, you know, for them to stumble, unless maybe Purdue can get them at the end.
Yeah. And it'd be an interesting, statistical test for Gil Marissa, one of our researchers, to find out how often in NCAA tournament history the two best teams actually ended up playing each other. Because I would say it's once every 15 years.
Probably. Well, I referenced Gonzaga and Baylor. Yeah. That was certainly a year.
Yes.
You could argue in 2008 that, all four one seeds made it. You had the Kansas-Memphis championship game. But it's not common.
No.
The other two teams in this field, other than UConn and Purdue, I mean, I marvel at Alabama's run to get there, because the Alabama team last year should have made it.
Sure.
Because they were the second best team, even though UConn was a lower seed. UConn was the best team last year. Alabama was the second best team who didn't win and didn't get there, to sort of to your point.
Yeah.
This year they've played extraordinarily well and gotten there. But the real fascinating one to me is North Carolina State. And it's because I was at the ACC tournament.
We had a lot of faith, if people remember the podcast recently.
Yeah.
We really, the bracket podcast, we couldn't have said enough nice things.
Well, I mean, the thing was they had to be out of gas. Everybody, every team that you would have thought it would have been out of gas. But that whole theory of, the butterfly effect, the butterfly flaps its wings and it sends things in different directions. This tournament is about, it's consumed the sport, and it's about validation and trafficking in hope. And what this tournament has done is given the NC State program hope, because that night in Washington, D.C., if Isaac McNealy makes that free throw before O'Connell banks in the, 30-foot three to force overtime, if he makes that free throw, then what you're dealing with is NC State kind of an up and down, largely disappointing season, sort of punctuated by couple of decent days in the ACC tournament and an upset of Duke. And then you get knocked out in the semifinal. And it is highly likely that at that point, North Carolina State says, well, we're going a different direction. We've got to generate some hope. We've got to generate some momentum and enthusiasm. And Kevin Keats is not a better coach now than he was. He was a good coach then. He was a good coach when they lost their last four regular season games or whatever. And he's a good coach now. But it's really something to watch, because if those things don't happen, North Carolina State is probably wondering, okay, how do we rev up the masses again? How do we generate some momentum? We probably have to make a change. And now instead, they have that momentum. They have the most lovable character in the entire tournament in DJ Burns. And, I don't think that, especially because they're skilled, they've had good players, they've just sort of had trouble finding their rhythm over the course of the regular season. I expect Purdue to win. I'm not going to be stunned if North Carolina State wins again at this point. Because they're a talented team.
Yeah, I think both underdogs, and they're both about 10-point underdogs. I think one's 11.5 and one is 9.5, something like that. I think they both have – there's a path for them winning this game, these games in the semis, right? Alabama can just get hot, right? That's their path. Do I think Alabama's going to win? No. There's a high variance level with the way they play. I think UConn can match their speed and skill. And that was the one thing that being in the Illinois locker room after the game – talking to some of their reserves who weren't out on the podium, they just kept saying they were fast. Like, that was the thing that they couldn't capture in prep, and it didn't show up on film, was just the general speed. So I don't think Alabama is going to be able to out-athlete UConn, and I think UConn's sound enough. And I don't think Alabama guards particularly well. So no, I don't think that's an outlandish statement.
That's not a secret. I mean, Oates has talked about that. He talked about that at the end of the SEC tournament. He's like, you got to decide if you want to stay around. And he's also sort of been of the philosophy of, they're so good offensively. They have holes offensively, because they don't have that, big swing man, muscular swing guy who can just go get you a bucket. You know, yes. they've got crafty smaller guards. They've got elite shooters in a lot of different places. And they've got a couple of capable ones who are, you know, young, a little bit hit and miss. But, you know, they are elite offensively. And he's like, you don't have to be great on defense. You just have to be a little bit better. But this is a different deal because their whole offensive system is predicated on threes and shots at the rim, with the exception of Aaron Estrada. And you can't score at the rim with Donovan Clingan. I mean, the most amazing stat that I know you witnessed with watching the UConn-Illinois game in person, when he was on the floor, Illinois was 5 of 38 from the floor. And if he contested the shot, if Donovan Clingan contested the shot, they were 0 for 19. First of all, credit to Donovan Clingan for contesting 19 shots. They didn't make one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so.
Terrence Shannon was just stopping. He was clearly like
in a headspace. I believe he got three shots blocked. They might not have counted one of them, but like he was like, it was clearly deep in his head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be an interesting thing. I don't think that, I mean, I could be wrong. I don't think Alabama, their guards anyway, when they drive, you know, have to be judicious about how to get around. If they're crafty around the rim, I don't think they'll worry about getting their shot blocked as much maybe as a Terrence Shannon would, and here's why. They're all little guys.
Yeah, sure.
They're used to it. You know, they've had their shots blocked before, and Terrence Shannon, it took a Herculean effort to get one of Terrence's shots this year, you know? So
Terrence attacks the rim.
Yes,
they're
crafty
toward the rim.
Yeah.
There's,
but yeah, I think it's quite a hill to climb. You know, I thought of this. What do you think of this philosophy for dealing with DJ Burns or Matt Painter and Purdue? As you know, Pete, as you follow this, you know that the Purdue band sports what they believe to be the world's largest drum.
Big drum.
So I would take the big drum, get it in Mackey Arena, which it will go in because we were there for College Game Day years ago. We started the show with the big Purdue drum inside Mackey. I would just put it in the lane, and I would just start it in the corner, and I would just bang. I would just bang on Zach Edey and make him hold his position against the drum, and that should be the closest approximation for trying to keep DJ Burns out of the lane, I think.
So it used to be like a $5 cab ride.
Then it became like a $5 Uber ride, probably a $15 Uber ride if it's surge pricing. So now it's just the world. They claim it to be the world's largest drum, by the way, but I believe there's a bigger one in Korea.
Is there
somewhere?
And
but
Texas,
even that one's probably not as big as DJ Burns, who is just becoming larger than life.
Yeah, I think Texas argues the drum too. But back to the more compelling discussion of DJ Burns, he reminds me there are some skills that are different. I feel like if memory serves, that Oliver Miller was a little more face up kind of guy, but I know the body types are similar. You know, big guys. DJ's extraordinarily lovable, but they're just
what about DeJuan Blair?
Yeah, okay. But he seems more of a bruiser. I mean, DJ has a deftness. DJ can dance on a light bulb. And Oliver Miller was like that. He had those big you would throw the ball to Oliver Miller as you do with DJ Burns, and it was as if you were just throwing it into a giant, feathery, cushiony, comfortable pillow. You know, the ball would just nestle in the hands, and he would find the right place to get it to. He's a really skilled player. And the fact that he's had the stamina that he's had and the gregarious nature that he's had with people, whether it be security guards or people watching the game, has been a joy to watch. I'm sure it has been for Kevin Keats for sure.
Yeah. We always talk about this in the podcast. Like, what will I remember about this NC State run 5 years from now? It'll be DJ Burns just dancing. Just impromptu dancing on the free throw line, like waiting for the, like just kind of kicking it. Like, like that he has just carried himself in a, you know, in an amazing way. Later this week, when we masquerade as football podcasters, we're going to have Matt Miller on. And the first question I'm going to ask Matt Miller is like, why is DJ Burns not the first tackle off the board in this NFL draft coming up? Because it was like Glenn Big Baby Davis when he came at LSU. Mm-hmm. It was just like, what a wonderful athlete, light feet, clearly agile, can like what that is a, he is a tackle. right?
Well, didn't Jim Nagy from the Senior Bowl say that several scouts and front office people had inquired about him, or he had gotten, not that he would have the answers, but had run that, I think I saw him tweet this, that people had inquired about DJ Burns. Because I think when you look at DJ, they list him at 6'9", 275, which is probably generous on both counts, depending on how you look at it. He's probably maybe not quite that tall. And, you know, he's probably, not probably, he's heavier than that. Hasn't impacted his play.
Nope.
But when you start getting, let's say he measured in 6'7.5", and let's say he tipped the scales at 330, that's tackle. With a guy who can move. And, you know, I don't know about punching with his hands, you know, and all of those things, and pass pro and kick sliding and all of that stuff. But I know he's got great hands, so he has the ability to use them. Maybe we lean him up a little bit and make him a tight end instead.
Sure. There's been a couple of guys like this.
Remember Mo Alley Cox? Mm-hmm. From VCU,
yeah,
went absolutely. On to be a very good NFL tight end for may still be playing.
Antonio Gates too. I mean,
Antonio Gates obviously is the sort of the shining the shining example. I just think, like, boy, DJ Burns has some gifts now. I still don't think he's an NBA player. Like, I just don't. You know, maybe I'm wrong. Like, just. Do you think he shoots? Like, I don't know how the game translates. Like, I think he could have been an NBA player in like the 90s. I just don't. Now, again, the skill set's unbelievable, right? The touch is unbelievable to a certain length. And obviously the passing is otherworldly, as good a big man passer as we've seen. But it would be hard to, like, take him out of basketball at this point. He's just like, put this indelible, moment, you know, back-to-back weekends, he's stolen America's heart, and be hard to throw a helmet on him and put him on the, you know, put him on the blind side. It just doesn't feel right.
I don't think, I mean, look, I don't know. I haven't talked to DJ about anything like this, and I'm sure he's not interested in talking about it, though he might. Someone will ask him about it this week at the Final Four at the podium, I'm sure. But it's a pretty good plan B if you want it, because it's not as if he tries basketball for a few years, hopefully it works out. It could be, hey, remember, I think it was our old friend Buck Showalter who doubted that Pat Connaughton would make it in the NBA and saying he should come throw this 95 mile an hour fastball for the Orioles now. Well, Pat Connaughton's worked out quite well in the NBA. You never know, different kind of players from Burns, but in the event that he gives pro basketball a shot a few years, and maybe if it's not going his way, nothing's going to change about the athleticism at that time. And he could give it a shot at that point. When you are a huge, huge guy, I mean, DJ's a big guy, but when you're Zach Edey or Donovan Klingon, even if the pro game has changed, there's a spot for you. You know, there's a spot for you in the NBA when you're that big. And I think also that when Donovan Klingon starts getting evaluated, I think anybody who masters the art of snow shoveling in the Nutmeg State in the greater Bristol, Connecticut area, as you have discovered this week about in a piece that's coming up, I think that has to be score some points in his favor, I would think.
Yeah, so we have a story coming out on
ESPN.com this week, a profile of Klingon. I was lucky enough to spend some time around him in Boston this weekend, and he is very likely America's tallest landscaper. For about 2.5-3 years when he was in high school, he worked for a gentleman by the name of Rich Brown, who I was lucky enough to chat with this week. And Rich has two sons who are Donovan's age. He played travel ball with his son, Austin. And in the winter, Rich Brown would pull up to Donovan Klingon's house at 3 a.m. Donovan would have already shoveled his own driveway, and he would get in, and Rich would drive him around, and he would plow, and Donovan would go and kind of do the periphery of the sidewalks and the different areas the plow couldn't get around the house. And then he'd either drop him off at school at 6, take him to Dunkin' Donuts, because we are New Englanders, and that is what we do. And then the summer, Donovan would landscape. Rich said his dump truck has a big crease in it because Donovan had a little accident with the yellow mower that that ended up putting a pretty good dent in the back of his truck. And he was a very diligent employee, except for that first day of the summer, Reese, when coaches can call recruits, because his phone kept ringing and he would be on lunch break and be like, give me a second, I have to talk to Tom Izzo, before he would go back to rake leaves. So he said, Mr. Brown, I'm going to get some phone calls today. It's like, yeah, the 7-footer with 100 offers is probably going to have a few coaches checking in. But he didn't take the day off from work. He kept rolling. So coaches, I got to go. I got to hop on the truck and go to the next yard to rake.
Does Donovan have any of the quirks or superstitions that his coach Dan Hurley does?
He did not reveal any of those, but boy, does Coach Hurley have some superstitions. You guys have had some fun with that on game day.
He always goes to the, because he thinks everybody wants to know about his boxers. I think at some point I'm going to tell him, Dan, I don't care about the boxers. It's the other weird little things. It's the sweatshirt that got M&Ms. Tossed in your office, and it's the M&Ms. You pull out the M&Ms and discard all of those that are the jersey color, the school color of your opponent. He's got a lucky hat. I think, Pete, because of their success and because he's a big personality and because he's yelling at a fan, I'm going to knock you out. he does this whole thing. He's the face of the sport right now. I mean, there are other successful coaches. You mentioned Tom Izzo as those. Sort of the dean right now, along with Bill Self, other guys who've been around for a long time. But the face of the sport in this moment in time, in terms of coaches, be Dan Hurley. And the fact that he's got this eccentric personality, I think only lends itself to making them more compelling.
Yes, the only thing I'm critical of coaches and how they are outward is if they're boring. And Dan Hurley, Reese, is not boring. Star turn for him. So you think about it. He brought up the name Teddy Allen. I was talking to him in the hallway in Boston after they clinched the Final Four, and I actually asked him about becoming one of the faces of the sport. And Teddy Allen was a vagabond, and that's not an insult. That's like an accurate career description. He played at like five schools in 6 years, something crazy. He ended up at New Mexico State for one of those years, and he scored 37 on UConn in the tournament in an awful rock fight of a game. New Mexico won a 12-5 game. That was a 22 tournament. So going into Danny Hurley's fifth season as UConn's coach, I believe, he had not won an NCAA tournament game. He lost to New Mexico State. He lost to Maryland. There was the COVID tournament, and they were bad his first year. I mean, he needed to win some games last year in the tournament. Like, I don't think his job was in danger, but it's UConn. Like, national titles are the standard there. It's a blue blood. I don't even think that's a conversation anymore. It's a blue blood.
Yeah.
You better win some games. And from that point on, he's won 10 NCAA tournament games, all by double digits, which nobody has ever done in history. So again, he was a very good coach. He was a very good coach at Rhode Island. He was a very good coach at Wagner. He was a good prep school coach, but he was not in that upper tier of the sport. You can't be if you've not won an NCAA tournament game at your current job. I believe he won one at Rhode Island. No, he won two at Rhode Island, I think. So again, he was not a stranger to the tournament, but he was a very good coach amid the constellation of other very good coaches. But like right now, He is on the cusp of becoming, if they win, and I think you and I both think they're going to win this weekend, one of only three coaches to have two national titles if he wins out. And the others are Self and Izzo, like you said. So I'm sorry. No, I made a mistake there. It's Self and Patino.
Yeah.
One of Patino's allegedly doesn't count, but we're going to count. So Izzo has only won that one in 2000. So like, what a just remarkable race to the top of the sport in a 12-month period. I don't know if I ever remember a coach just asserting himself in the elite as quickly as he has. He went from, the cul-de-sac in the really nice house, with the two-car garage to the penthouse really quickly.
And he did it because his teams don't engage really in those rock fights anymore.
Yeah.
They're faster. They're more fluid on offense. They score more. I remember You know, remember that New Mexico State game that you referenced, and the problem with UConn for a while was that, like several teams that you see now, they can go into these stone cold, you know, inefficient offensive times. And now they have answers. This team last year too, but this team particularly has answers, as we mentioned earlier, if they don't shoot it well and they get fast break points and they, you know, and they get it out off a rebound and they go down and get an easy shot. And it's, you know, it's a joy to watch, man. And he's, you know, he's constantly, you know, Seth Greenberg talks a lot about, because Seth and Danny are close, and, you know, one of Danny's confidants. I don't think that's any secret to say. And, you know, Seth's been in film room with them, and he is really tough on players. And you say, well, so what? A lot of coaches are. But, you know, he's been of the opinion that because Storrs is where it is, because UConn, as I mentioned in the essay, I said, is neither hot spot nor garden spot. Yeah. And I don't mean, it's a nice place. It's a nice little
great place to go to school.
Right. And if you go there, you know what you're signing up for, whether it was with Calhoun back in the day or with Danny now, you're going there to be elite at basketball. Now, I'm not talking about at the expense of your student experience. I just mean in terms of what you're going for your basketball life, you know what you're signing up for. And it's a really remarkable thing. He fits there perfectly. I had Kendrick Perkins the other day when he was on the Pat McAfee show when I was on there, and he mentioned Danny as an NBA coach. And I said, with the temperament work.
Don't go to the NBA.
Perk says yes.
Ooh, I think Perk's wrong.
Perk said he referenced a couple of guys who were tough, Thibodeau, you know, guys who are tough on their players. And he said, if you earn that respect, you can do that.
Do you agree with that?
I'm skeptical of that. Not that he couldn't do it, because I think Danny is a smart coach.
Yeah, he's a good coach.
He could, and he's a smart person who could adapt.
Yes.
But to truly be himself, yeah, and the way, you know, just sort of that, the way he carries himself, I think it's a better fit in college. He would have to make some adjustments if he were to decide to do that.
Extract his Hurley family DNA out of his body. I think a lot of Danny Hurley, I've known him since he was prep school coach. That's a terrible idea. All right. I'm just going to say that. Him as an NBA coach is a terrible idea. He could go on and be an all-time great college coach, right? If this weekend, you know, unfolds like we think it's going to, he could be on a trajectory to be a Hall of Fame type, you know, iconic college coach. And I just don't think he is wired for 82 games. I mean, he's very smart and he's very tactical, but he runs hot, man. That guy runs on emotion.
Yes,
he's wonderfully unfiltered. And I don't think you can roll like that through 82 games. And if he would get an NBA job, it probably wouldn't be like an elite tier one. So you'd have to roll through and lose a lot of games. And I don't think he's wired to do that. So again, wonderful coach. He's done an unbelievable job. And maybe I'm secretly like want him in college basketball because that's the space we're in. And he's an interesting, sort of tortured, fascinating, honest, hilarious guy.
Yeah.
Did you see the quote out of Boston when he was talking about how he was like, I'm my authentic self. It's just sometimes I'm an asshole. And so I wrote that and I put it in the tweet that I sent out in the column because I thought it was an honest quote and kind of funny. And I was a little bit like, I wonder how this will be like if I highlight that. I wonder how it'll be. His athletic director retweeted it.
You know what? When you have the personality that he does,
yeah,
you're better off to embrace it and not pretend it doesn't exist.
Correct.
You know, I mean, that's and that's one of the reasons why I think his players respond to him when he, you know, when he goes in on them, you know, for like, you know, after the Creighton game, for the, you know, defensive rotations or shot selection or whatever it might be, go in on him. But they know that he has their back. They know he's right. They know he cares. All of those things. And I think the connection too is pretty fascinating. You know, he'll be going against Alabama and Nate Oates, who, oddly enough, also former high school coach, who they connected when Danny was when Bobby and Danny were recruiting one of Nate's players at Romulus High School in Michigan.
E.C. Matthews.
Yeah, E.C. Matthews. And when we had Nate on game day on Saturday, and during the middle of the interview, he was on FaceTime on his phone from the team hotel, Bobby Hurley buzzed in. You know,
that's funny.
I was like, I bet he's not calling to give you a scouting report, right? You're like, you need one. You kind of see what you're getting there. But there are all of these connections, I think, throughout that you see in the coaching industry.
Sure.
But the one thing that I'm not going to listen to anymore is all of this, you know, hard scrabble Jersey City toughness anymore. I'm done with that. You know why?
Why?
Somebody from Jersey City, I don't know if you saw this or not, won like $1 billion in the lottery. So, I mean, people come out of there. Now there's some silver spoon issues now in Jersey City, because
Jersey City is a pretty tough place. It has actually kind of gotten
anymore,
gentrified a little
not
bit.
Not anymore. The guy won $1 billion there, and Danny Hurley's from there, and all the Hurleys. I mean, you know, I'm not listening to this anymore. I've had enough of it. I've had enough. When Seth Greenberg starts talking again about this Jersey City stuff, yeah, I'm going to tell him, well, they just roll out there and go to the grocery store and pick up a lottery ticket, win $1 billion. Good things happen in Jersey City.
Can I leave us
out of there and they win national championships, they win $1 billion in the lottery. I don't want to, you know, I'm not listening to that anymore.
Can I leave us here with my favorite Hurley family story?
Please.
So it's 2015. Danny's at Rhode Island. They play Iona in an NIT game on either Monday or Tuesday night of that week. And then Bob is at Buffalo. And they're playing West Virginia in the first round of the NCAA tournament that week in Columbus. So I live up in Boston. I go down to that NIT game. Danny gets thrown out of the game by a referee by the name of Wally Ratecki. And he is just like apoplectic, like after the game, like unconsolable. You know, it's embarrassing to get thrown out. He obviously pushes the ledger a lot. So anyway, there's a lot of not kind words post game in the, you know, back hallways of the Ryan Center about Wally Ratecki. So, and his dad's there. They're all like, there's nothing aggrieves the Hurley family more than officials. So anyway, I remember it was in Columbus because I had talked to Cardale Jones, I went to practice the day before. So anyway, and it's a 12-5 game, Buffalo, West Virginia. Buffalo has a pretty good chance to win. So I walk in the arena at noon, and one of the first people I see is Bob Senior. And he looks at me and he goes, "You'll never guess who's officiating this game." And I was like, "Who?"
Oh, no.
Wally Ratecki. And I mean, that it was in everybody's head there. It was hilarious. So Buffalo's kind of hanging around like you're doing a 12-5 game. And again, this is a long time ago. I've seen a lot of game sets. There's a big and one that kind of helps West Virginia pull away. You know who called it?
Wally Ratecki. And for the record, because everybody gets so bent out of shape and serious about every little thing you say in a facetious nature, Pete Thamel did not mean to indicate that Wally Ratecki made an erroneous call. He believes in the integrity of officials, just as I believe that all games of chance come with a certain amount of risk. But I just wanted to have your back there so that.
I appreciate it. I was not insinuating anything. Now, the Hurley family may have differed in their opinion, but I certainly had no qualms with Wally Ratecki.
Is there a coach alive who's ever had a call go against him? And that's a good call.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
There's always, if it was a good call, it was, yeah, but you didn't call that on the other end, you know, at the same time. So
yes,
that's a great story, by the way. And just for the record, one thing we need to clean up from the story you told earlier, no custom snow shovel for Donovan Klingon.
I should have noted that. He just bent over and used the regular one. Yeah.
That is rough on the lower back.
Yeah.
That could be an L5 situation there. That's tough. Holy cow. All right. Yeah. Pete, great work. I look forward to seeing you in Phoenix for the men's Final Four. Women's Final Four is going to be amazing, too, on the
awesome
ESPN platform and networks, big stars and all of that. We've got tremendous storylines in Phoenix as well. Thanks for listening to the College Game Day podcast. Subscribe or download this wherever you prefer to get your podcasts.